Today at Reader's Corner, David Gellis, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1981, Jack Welch took over General Electric and quickly rose to fame as a celebrity CEO. He golfed with presidents, mingled with movie stars, and was idolized for growing GE into the most valuable company in the world. But Welch's achievements didn't stem from some greater intelligence or business prowess. In his latest book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism, David Gellis argues that Welch single-handedly ushered in a new cutthroat era of American capitalism that continues to this day. David Gellis is a reporter for the New York Times. Since joining the Times in 2013, he has written about CEOs, finance, technology, media, and more. He is the author of the 2015 book Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. David Gellis, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you say that Jack Welch's career serves as a line of demarcation for the history of capitalism in America, David. How so?
It's important to remember that the economy we live in today is not the economy that people were familiar with for much of the 20th century. If you think about those post-war years and sort of the social contract between big companies and the American public, it was very different. There was a real emphasis by corporate leaders, by corporations, by CEOs to be good corporate citizens, to do their part to make the community, the country, a better place. All of that changed when Welch took control of GE. And we'll talk about the details of how he did it. But I am confident in saying that, as you said, it was a line of demarcation. There was a before Jack Welch and an after Jack Welch. And we're still living in Jack Welch's world today.
Well, summarize for us the tools that he would employ to accomplish the goals of this crusade he was on.
I identify three main tools he used to employ what I call Welchism, which was this ideology he employed to really revolutionize not just GE, but all of corporate America, I argue. And those three tools were downsizing, deal making, and financialization. And just to briefly take them one by one, downsizing, I'm afraid we all know all too familiar what that is. That's mass layoffs. That's factory closures. That's outsourcing and offshoring. And during his time at GE, Welch single-handedly oversaw the firing of some 250,000 hardworking Americans. When it comes to deal making, that's mergers and acquisitions. That's buying and selling other companies. Welch did more deals than anyone in history. During his time as CEO, he struck something like 1,000 mergers and acquisitions at GE, making GE not the industrial conglomerate that it was when he took over, but this sprawling entity that was involved in everything from media to finance to everything else. And that third one is financialization. The real engine of growth during his time at GE was GE Capital, this entity inside the company that started as sort of a small lending business, but grew to become what was essentially an unregulated bank. And the way in which Welch used GE Capital to smooth out its earnings and inflate its earnings over the years, but also get into all sorts of arcane lending businesses, really helps explain not only how GE got so big during Welch's tenure, but how it fell so far in the years after he left.
I think I read in your book where you also point out that Welch was really good at dealing with those quarterly earnings reports, and he would take certain actions right before the deadline of those reports to make GE look perhaps a lot better than it really was. Could you walk us through that? I think that has to do with the mergers and acquisitions.
It has to do with all of it. Just to level set here, the way Wall Street works is there's a bunch of stock analysts who read quarterly reports and think about the economy and then estimate how much money a corporation is going to make in a 90-day period, quarter to quarter. The company then essentially lives or dies by how close they come in to those estimates. most companies don't have a whole lot of leverage over how much they can change that number quarter to quarter. But the way Welch structured GE gave him almost unlimited power to shape GE's quarterly earnings and make them just about exactly where analysts wanted them. And so the way he did that was largely through GE Capital, but also through mergers and acquisitions, but it was also through downsizing. If they saw that they were, you know, going to be a little below their profits for the quarter, they could strike a quick deal with one of their financial assets. They could lay some people off, fire some people, and take a tax write-off because of it. They could close a factory and write it off as an unexpected cost. And so they had this magical ability to hit the numbers. And as a result, they meet or beat analyst expectations for something close to 80 quarters in a row. No company had ever done anything like that in the past. Mm-hmm. And it was almost immediately after Welch retired that a lot of people, including the SEC, including major investors on Wall Street, started to look back on this and say, wait, something was not right about all that.
So what does the acquisition of RCA and Kidder Peabody allow Welch to accomplish for GE?
That was one of these big signature deals that he struck in the 1980s. And that was one of the deals that really served many functions. On the one hand, it just made GE bigger. And that was one of his stated aims from the get-go. He wanted GE to be number one or number two in every industry it was in. And that allowed him to sort of consolidate certain appliance businesses, for example. The next thing it did was allow him to really get a major toehold in the media business. In buying RCA, he acquired NBC, which essentially made Jack Welch a media mogul overnight. And then there was also, right around the same time, the acquisition of Kidder Peabody, which was an investment bank, which struck him in and got him going on Wall Street. And so all of a sudden, in those first few years after he takes over GE, it's no longer just a company making light bulbs and dishwashers. Suddenly, they're running media entities and network television. And they're also one of the biggest investment banks on Wall Street, getting into everything from, you know, hedge fund financing to private equity deal.
Mm-hmm. I think Welch made a comment when he took over GE that he wanted to blow it up. And I wonder if you could help us understand what it was he was after in blowing it up. What did the traditional GE look like? It was an engineering company, for one thing, and it was also, I guess, an innovation company.
It was. And I think, you know, we can read into those remarks, but it's important to recognize the context in which he was saying that. Things needed to change. He was right about that. In the 1970s and in 1980 and 1981, the year he took over, the U.S. economy was relatively stagnant. They were suffering from stagflation. You know, that did not help Jimmy Carter's reelection prospects when he finally ceded the White House to Ronald Reagan. And so there was absolutely a moment where something had to give. The economy was stagnant. Inflation was intense. It was a moment that, you know, many economists say looks somewhat like the economy we're living in today. But the way in which Welch went about reforming GE and revolutionizing corporate America was extreme at every level. And instead of simply spending a bit more on R&D, trying to jumpstart that innovation you just mentioned, he went absolutely nuclear. He started laying off people by the tens of thousands. He started disposing of businesses as fast as he was acquiring new ones. And he went whole hog into the business of finance, which was the fastest growing part of the U.S. economy at the time. And so the GE that people knew from most of the 20th century, as you said, this engineering culture that was singularly focused on making great products and services that you could rely on. All of a sudden, GE was a sort of amorphous entity chasing profits wherever Welch could find them.
So Welch's tenure at GE coincided with the Reagan presidency. What gift does Reagan give Welch and his fellow capitalists that allows them to keep their stock prices high and higher?
Well, I don't think there was one gift, but Reaganomics, which is this sort of principle of small government, less regulation, a real embrace of finance, permeated the Reagan administration. It was reflective of the major people he put in place in the administration. And so all of a sudden we had a Wall Street banker running the SEC for the first time in decades. It was reflective in some of the policy changes that were made, including what was essentially a green light for stock buybacks. You know, companies using their profits to buy back their own stock, which essentially drives their own stock price up. You know, that was illegal for 50 years because it's essentially stock manipulation. But under Reagan, suddenly it's legal. And Reagan also, the Reagan administration, gave the green light for GE to acquire RCA, that signature deal that we talked about just a couple of minutes ago. That was forbidden by antitrust laws for many years. Under Reagan, they get the go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And this wasn't necessarily a partisan effort. I think you point out in your book that Democrats played a role here, too.
They sure did. And if you look at, you know, certainly the tenure of Bill Clinton, it was that sort of free market embrace, this belief that globalization and minimal regulation were going to allow essentially, you know, a rising tide in the stock market to lift all boats. Well, that was music to the ears of men like Welch and other CEOs at the time. So, no, I mean, listen, the Republican administration got this going. And I think you could make a strong argument that Republicans in general are still more pro-business, anti-regulation than Democrats. But there's been plenty of examples of Democrats doing the bidding of corporate America as well.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is David Gelis, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism. Welch created GE University. What role does that play in your tale here?
Well, that was the colloquial name for an entity known as Crotonville, or I think officially it was the GE Management Development Center, like something like that. But effectively, this was GE's in-house business school. This is where Welch disciples and executives at the company would go to learn about how to be more like Jack Welch. It was where they would go. It's an upstate retreat in New York where they would go and really try to understand what Welch wanted and how he wanted it to be achieved. And it was where, at the end of the day, dozens and dozens of executives from GE learned how to mimic the Jack Welch playbook and ultimately went on to take it to other companies. Dozens and dozens of men who studied directly with Welch at GE would go on to run and become CEO of other four public major American corporations and employ essentially the very same playbook.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of those you mentioned, and you mentioned more than a couple, but Harry Stonecipher went to McDonnell Douglas, Larry Johnston wound up here in Boise leading Albertsons. And I mean, there's a lot of people listening to this interview that could tell you how Larry Johnson lost Albertsons and enhanced his own cash portfolio, but I'm going to let you do that instead. So why don't you just give us a thumbnail sketch of these two guys and what they did when they left GE?
Sure thing. Well, they were two of the many. Harry Stonecipher, the first you mentioned, he was a Jack protege who was at Boeing, as you say, went to McDonnell Douglas, another aircraft maker, but then ultimately sold McDonnell Douglas to Boeing and became the CEO of Boeing. And Stonecipher then becomes one of three CEOs over the last 25 years at Boeing who worked directly for Welch at GE. And this is really one of the major ways I got onto this story. And one of the major reasons I wrote this book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism, is because when I was a reporter at the New York Times a few years ago, I covered the fallout from the crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX tragedies. Yeah. And as we dug into it, it became clear that these CEOs from GE had radically transformed Boeing. And Stonecipher was the first of them. And we can talk, if you want, about the others. You also mentioned Larry Johnston, another Jack Welch protege who left right around the time Welch retired, took over Albertsons, the grocery store chain, which you all know well there in Boise, and did what so many Welch proteges did when they arrived at a new company, which was try to run their companies just the way Jack ran GE. And that looked like firing people. It looked like closing stores, which is a pretty counterintuitive thing for them to do. It looked like trying to save money and pinch pennies in any way they could. I remember this story where Johnson tried to use less lighting in the grocery stores to save electricity costs. And all of a sudden, you know, who wants to walk down a dark aisle in a supermarket? Not I. And of course, what was he how was he rewarded for taking all these actions? Well, he got an enormous payday that had absolutely no accountability. And when a few years later, the company's in much worse shape than it was when he arrived, well, he still gets to keep his money. And the people who suffered, the stockholders who suffered, they are left holding the bag. Mm-hmm. The story repeats itself ad infinitum with Jack Welch proteges. And one of the major examples, as you said, that I focused on was Larry Johnson at Albertsons.
Right. Well, share with our listeners what the Wall Street Journal learned when they decided to track the men who followed in Welch's footsteps, these acolytes that were at GE University and learning under his wing. Didn't work out too well.
A vast majority oversaw drastic reductions in their company's value during their time. And their whole promise was that they had the Midas touch, just like Jack did, and they were going to get to keep their company's stock price going up and up and up. And instead, what happens is when they get in there and they start doing the downsizing and the deal making and the financialization, almost inevitably, it doesn't work out. And the stock market, for the most part, saw through it with these companies, where it took a much longer time for them to see through it with Welch.
So there were three candidates for Welch's job when he decides to retire. A guy named Bob Nardelli, who wound up at Home Depot, Jim McNerney, who winds up back in your book because he went to Boeing after Stonecipher, and Jeff Immelt, who, of course, gets the job. We've already covered how these guys do. We don't have time to go into the specifics, but I want to talk about Immelt a little bit because that is still the GE story, and you do a wonderful job in your book of carrying on this tale of just what's happening. Immelt picked up on Welch's fondness for acquisitions when he bought Western Asset Mortgage Capital. I wonder if you could share with us, for our listeners who may not know, where that leads GE.
Well, this is one of the biggest subprime lenders in America in the early 2000s. And just to pause there, and think about the company that Thomas Edison founded, one of the most reliable producers of industrial goods, suddenly in the early aughts, deciding that the best thing for this company was going to be to buy a subprime mortgage lender, makes it clear just how far GE had strayed from its historic roots under Welch and then Immelt. And of course, that story doesn't end well. Within a matter of years, the financial crisis hits. Subprime mortgages are the most toxic asset on Wall Street. And GE ultimately needs a $100-something billion bailout from the federal government and Warren Buffett just to make it through a pretty treacherous day in September of 2008. But that was just one example of some of the crazy financial instruments that Welch and then Immelt got GE into. And it represents sort of this real abandonment of what made the company great in the first place.
You know, at this stage of the game, you're really thinking, was anybody onto this? Did anybody get this? And at one point in your book, you share with the reader some of the people in the media who just fell all over themselves, heaping praise on this guy, from Dan Rather to Matt Lauer, Katie Couric, Charlie Rose, Al Roker, Ann Curry. I mean, I guess the next question is, how's the business press during these years dealing with this guy? Did any of these guys see through what was going on at the time?
Very few. Yeah. And this is something I write about and something I'm frankly reckoning with, my own role in the business press. For the longest time, people, especially during the last 15 years or so of Welch's tenure, really celebrated just about every move he made. Now, it's important to note that in the early years, before he had really turned things around at GE and got the stock price moving up, people called him Neutron Jack. You know, people saw the mass layoffs and they thought, wait a sec, that's not how things have been going. But almost as quickly, people started singing his praises pretty unequivocally and believing that the way he was running GE was the right way to run a company. And that was the end of the story. Now, very few people saw through it at the time. There was one good book towards the end of his tenure called At Any Cost that detailed some of these shenanigans. Shortly after he retired, Bill Gross, the legendary bond investor, called him out and said that there was real suspicion in the way he had been running GE. But on balance, no, people went along for the ride.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with David Gelis, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. So perhaps his greatest legacy at GE is best described by Eric Ries. He's a consultant and an author who you bring up in your book, who I guess he came in to assess GE's culture. Now here's this engine, this original engineering culture that was so good at inventing. What does Ries find?
Well, Ries was among these consultants who came in during Jeff Immelt's tenure and were charged with essentially sort of kickstarting innovation at the company. And what they found was a culture that was so ossified, so focused on delivering quarterly profits, with an employee base that was essentially so fearful of taking any risk that it was ultimately impossible to really turn the company around without really digging it up from the roots. And no one at the company had the appetite to do that. And so here again, we see the legacy of Jack Welch, a company that was one of the most innovative in the world for much of the 20th century, gets itself into the 21st century and doesn't even have the appetite to take risks, has lost the muscles for real innovation.
You know, there's something in your book about what I would call the unjustified largesse of these companies, of these CEOs in particular. And even though it may not be the central point of your book, I wonder if you could share with our listeners Welch's retirement life, what kind of a deal he struck for himself in this case. I think it may be a deal he struck way back when he was originally hired. But when I read what his life was like after retirement, I mean, it's really disgusting is the only word I can think of.
Listen, I really think this is central to what the book's all about. Ultimately, this isn't just a book about one man, I hope. This is really a book about a system. And it's the system we're all still living in. And it's a system that rewards CEOs and executives with million, multi-million, $10 million, $100 million paydays for often overseeing a real degradation in the livelihoods of the people they employ. That's an uncomfortable truth, but it's the reality. You look at CEOs around the country right now who, faced with the slightest hardship in the stock market, faced with just the glimmer of weakness, the potential of a possible recession, and you know, the threat of some inflation that might persist, they take to laying off people by the thousands as a way to improve the profitability of their companies. And yet, what do they get at the end of the year? Irrespective of how they treated their employees, they get gargantuan paydays. It's out of control. It's absolutely out of control. And there's very little sign, I'm afraid to say, that anyone is doing anything about it. But that's the world that Welch helped create as one of the signature CEOs in the 80s and 90s who got these enormous paydays. And yes, you mentioned his retirement, $417 million just to retire. Thank you very much. But he was the first, and everyone else is still playing the game today.
And one of the things about that game that got me was his successor, Immelt. When Immelt would fly his plane, in case it broke down, he had a chase plane, a jet, the second jet behind the one he was in. I mean, that I've never heard of. I know these guys fly around in, you know, the latest jets off the assembly line, but never dreamed that you'd actually have an empty plane behind the CEO just in case there's a breakdown.
Not even presidents travel like this. Right. I mean, it was not only an example of the degree to which these men lived like, you know, imperial CEOs, but it was also a demonstration of what I think can only be described as sort of a disregard for their shareholders' investment, right? This was the shareholders' money at the end of the day they were using. This is the stockholders' capital. And to use it so irresponsibly, to me, shows a real disconnect with what they always say their stated mission is, which is to make money for their shareholders. They can't even do that with a straight face.
So let's end this conversation on an optimistic note, as you do in your book. In fact, the last chapter has some recommendations for change in it that I think are very important. What I'd like you to do, David, is talk to us about the Unilever president, Paul Polman, a slightly different approach to management and leadership in the private sector.
Well, hey, Welch set the precedent, and most CEOs, I got to say, are still following his playbook. But what I discovered in the course of my reporting at the Times and for the reporting in this book is that there's at least a few CEOs who are trying to do some things somewhat differently. I'm careful not to give them too much credit because a lot of them are, you know, doing some good with one hand, but just repeating the same old mistakes with the other. But what Paul Polman did was essentially try to uproot Welchism in his own company, which was Unilever, this multinational provider. You know, they make everything from Ben and Jerry's ice cream to Dove soap. And so he stopped reporting quarterly estimates. So he didn't want to play that game with the Wall Street analysts. He stopped trying to maximize his short-term profits. He started really trying to take good care of his employees and make sure that they were making a living wage, that they were enjoying some of the fruits of the labor that they were all working so hard at. He started paying real heed to the environmental impacts of his company. He started taking real care about the supply chain and looking at how his suppliers, all the farmers in these, you know, often developing countries, were faring. And all of that, you know, decision by decision, amounted to a real different way to go about doing business. And Paul Polman, you know, had a very good record. It was not the most profitable company, but it was one that people looked to for real guidance on how they might strike a respectable balance with all of their stakeholders, in the same way that people used to look to GE.
Your book certainly deals with income inequality by showing just how many people have abused the system, CEOs at the top especially. I wonder if you could talk about Dan Schulman at PayPal, because he gets down to the nitty-gritty of what does an individual need to live on in these days? And he wanted to address that. Please share with us.
Dan Schulman is another one of the CEOs that I point out is starting to do some things differently. Again, not perfect, not totally complete, you could argue. But what Dan realized is that even at PayPal, a very profitable technology company, some of his lowest paid workers, call center workers, for example, in places like Phoenix, Arizona, they were having to choose between gas money and textbooks for their kids. They were having to choose between Christmas presents and health insurance. And when he realized that, he understood he had to do something differently. And so what he did was a very comprehensive financial wellness program. He gave them all raises. He gave them all stock in the company. He gave them financial literacy training so they could really understand how to manage their money in a more effective way. But then the most effective thing he did was just start paying for more of their out-of-pocket healthcare costs. And that alone was one of the most impactful things he did. Mm-hmm. And all of that amounts to, you know, a real reshaping of the contract between employer and worker, because things have gotten so out of whack for so long. You know, it's not uncommon for men and women at some of the most prosperous companies in the history of humanity, these companies that are making billions of dollars of quarterly profits, to still have a hard time getting by. And I don't think it's controversial to say that something is broken when that's the situation.
You just said men and women and reminded me of another thing that crossed my mind as I was reading your book It's always about the Welsh men. Never heard too much about the Welsh women, except from the editor of the Harvard Business Review, who, of course, Welsh wound up marrying. Could you tell me whether or not Jack Welsh spent any time mentoring and recruiting women into his organization?
Very few.
Yeah.
Very few. There were a couple, but you cannot point to any women who worked directly with him who went on to be the CEOs of major companies in the same way that you can with the men. Listen, it was a different era, though. He was not alone in having mostly male lieutenants in the 1980s and 90s. But no, your point is right on.
Well, we've run out of time, but David, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your writing this book and allowing us to get you on the air to talk about it. The name of the book is The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welsh Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America and How to Undo His Legacy by David Gellis. We haven't been able to get through everything in this book. David, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.